looking for when you buy a bottle of wine. If you're alone, do you reach for the clean skin? If you're sharing it with friends, maybe you want something a bit more fancy, a wine to show off, mark you as someone who knows their shit. If you're taking it to your parents' house or giving it as a gift, perhaps you look closer to the top of the shelf or judge the wine by its cover. Maybe you look for the award stamps that mean other people have swirled and spit out your Cabernet and judged it to be worth your time. I might judge a wine by its label, like if it's pretty and it has nice shapes, but how do the professionals do it? And do they get it right? Does it matter if they don't? Yasmin Parry has the story.
In 1976, one seemingly unremarkable event changed the wine world forever. It's been called the tasting of the century and the Cinderella story of wine, but it's most commonly known as the Judgment of Paris.
So the Judgment of Paris is where the old world of very high quality French wines was pitted against the new world of very high quality American wine.
That's Julie McIntyre.
I'm a central scholar in the Wine Studies Research Network at the University of Newcastle.
To help Julie and I tell this story, I've recruited another wine expert.
Dr. Alex Russell. I studied a PhD at the University of Sydney in the School of Psychology in taste and smell perception, and I specialise there in wine expertise.
He's also a wine retailer and writer.
The French in particular are very set in their ways. They don't like to change much at all.
The French have been making wine for thousands of years, and they're extremely protective of their reputation as winemakers. There are marketing campaigns, legislation, even a government body, the AOC, that regulates exactly how their wine is made. This is the body that ensures you can only buy champagne in France and everything else in the world has to be called plain old sparkling wine. So it's not an accident that when you think fine wine, you usually think of France.
They have this huge legacy going back a long time with their wines, and they don't like to admit that other people can do it better sometimes.
In the 1970s, a British wine merchant named Stephen Spurrier was living and working in Paris. He owned a little wine shop and a wine school, and he'd heard rumours that California were making fantastic wines.
By the mid-70s, there's some really interesting wines being made in Napa Valley in California. And Stephen Spurrier goes to explore this, expecting that he wouldn't find genuine challengers to the French throne of wine quality.
So Spurrier picked up some Chardonnays and some Cabernets and he brought them back to France.
He set up a blind tasting against, you know, a lot of the best of the French. And I'm talking the best of the French, you know, the things that are thousands of dollars.
On the panel were France's most esteemed wine tasters, the Inspector General of the AOC, the Director of the Academy of Wine, top restaurant owners, journalists and sommeliers.
The wines were poured into glasses and you weren't told which bottle they were from or anything like that.
And they got to tasting. The judges didn't expect the American wines to do well.
These critics, as they were, you know, sort of holding forth on the quality of each wine, knowing that some were American and some were French, slammed some of the wines that were French, thinking they were American.
One judge, Raymond Oliver, sipped a 1972 Chardonnay from the Napa Valley and said, ah, back to France.
They were even commenting things like, oh, this one's clearly French, it's superior, and this one's obviously Californian, it's simple and it's rustic.
So the judges voted and the votes were tallied. And then something extraordinary happened.
The United States were judged to be better.
California wines took out first place not only in the white category, but in the coveted red as well.
One of the French judges tried to get her cards back because she was very embarrassed. And a lot of the wines that they described as clearly French happened to be American and vice versa as well.
Reporters from around the world were invited, but only one showed up, George Tabor from Time magazine, who'd only come because he was having a slow news day. Tabor's article was published and word got out. America had made it.
And then out came the knives from people within the wine world saying, well, it can't be true. And there was a lot of anger and concern. And given that French wine culture really is a deeply embedded part of the national psyche, it's very important. Whereas the Americans were this kind of, they're new, what do they know about it? So it really, really did cause genuine waves.
The French were outraged and the fallout was devastating for the judges. The head of the AOC almost lost his job and the mayor of Margaux was asked to resign. Spurrier was banned from the prestige wine tasting tour for a year as punishment. And the French press didn't cover the story at all.
What it signified was an unseating of what was a long-held belief about the fact that you would automatically be able to tell that French wines were better than American wines, which is the old world, new world dichotomy.
As George Tabor wrote, if the soils of the Napa Valley could produce wine that bested the best of Burgundy and Bordeaux, what can be done in Australia, South Africa and Chile?
It's not just old world, new world. It's old world as art, new world as science, technology and so on.
The new world was here and it meant business.
We made it in America, sweet baby Jesus.
These days, we take it for granted that good wine doesn't have to come from the old world. In fact, if you order the house white at your local bar, you're more than likely to end up with a Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. And that's a trend that's extremely frustrating for Australian winemakers. If you cast your mind back to the 1980s, Australian Chardonnays were all the rage. But just as fashion and art and music are subject to the faddish tastes of consumers, so too is wine. And by the 90s, Chardonnay had become deeply uncool. In fact, the Foster's Group, who make wine, not just beer, convened a crisis summit in 2009. The CEO told the summit, "It's not just its heavy, oaky taste that's an issue. Chardonnay has an image problem. And it's one that can largely be pinned on these ladies."
Would you like a Cabernet, Kylie?
Stupid girl, Kim, it's not Chardonnay. The correct pronunciation is Chardonnay.
Mum, it's French. The H is silent. Back me up here, Kylie.
Yeah, she's right, Mrs. Deer. I've been to Paris and the H is silent. It's Chardonnay.
Oh, excuse me for living, Kylie. Mm.
He said Kath and Kim had helped to ruin Chardonnay's image. But could a comedy TV show really unseat an entire varietal? Are we wine drinkers that fickle?
Oh, Mike Beeseth.
I called Mike Beeseth, a wine economist and professor based at the University of Puget Sound. Mike told me pop culture has a big impact on trends in the wine world, and he said Kath and Kim was not an isolated incident.
Oh, yeah. No, in England, there was a similar reaction. There was a movie, oh, I've forgotten it, about a sad 30-ish woman who had terrible dates and would drown her tears, as it happens, in big glasses of Australian Chardonnay.
Was it Bridget Jones's Diary? Is it that one?
Yeah, no, it's not that particular one, but I wish I could remember the name.
It was, of course, Bridget Jones.
And Oz Clark, a British wine writer, blamed the slump in Australian Chardonnay sales on her. But here in the U.S., of course, we had our sideways effect.
Do not sabotage me.
Where sideways was that movie where the hero would only drink Pinot Noirs, and he said bad things about Merlot.
I am not drinking any fucking Merlot!
Okay, relax, Miles. Jesus, no Merlot. Did you bring your Xanax?
And it certainly caused a boom in the Pinot Noir sales, and Merlot sales at least leveled off. They might have declined a little bit. But we live in the age of media power, the age of celebrity. It's not a surprise that if a famous rapper decides that there's a certain brand of champagne that is just what he wants, that other people will buy it. And that happened too.
Here, Mike is referring to a very famous love affair between the rapper Jay-Z and a brand of luxury champagne called Cristal.
He made the decision that he would champion it as the drink of choice.
This is Rowan Dix.
Otherwise known as Joyride, one part of rap group One Day, and also host The Drop on FBI Radio, the rap show on Monday nights.
Also, I feel like I should mention that you and I are friends.
I wouldn't call it that. We've shared a few champagnes in our time, yes?
That's true. I feel like we're overqualified to talk about this. Yeah.
In 1994, Jay-Z started to drink Cristal in the clubs when few of his contemporaries had ever heard of it.
The inspiration for that was it was that next shit. You know, it was the obscure brand that the other guys weren't drinking, that was cooler, that was a bit different, and that's how he wanted to portray himself as well.
In his memoir Decoded, Jay-Z wrote, "We didn't have a record deal yet, but back then we'd show up at clubs in Lexuses and buy bottles of Cristal, while most people in the clubs were buying Moet."
Majority of his songs, if he was talking about what he was drinking, it would be Cristal. He'd talk about different pronunciations, like in "Excuse Me, Miss" at the start, he talks about having to be classy. He's like, "You got to roll a J to this one. You got to sip Cristal.
You can't even drink Cristal in this one. You got to drink Cristal."
The Cristal obsession spread to other rappers like Kanye West, Trina and P. Diddy.
And that became the drink of choice for everyone through the late 90s, early 2000s.
It was the type of endorsement a brand can only dream of, and Jay-Z was offering it up for free. But it was a love affair that was doomed to fail. In 2006, The Economist interviewed Friedrich Ruzard, who'd just taken over from his father as the new MD of Cristal. He was asked if an association with hip-hop, or as the interviewer put it, the bling lifestyle, could hurt the Cristal brand.
He basically said that there was nothing they could do with regards to Jay-Z linking himself with the drink. He's like, "We can't stop people from buying it, but there are other champagne companies that I'm sure would be delighted to have their business." Basically casting away any link that they had with the rap community.
Jay-Z called for a Cristal boycott.
Jay-Z took that as racist and basically said, "We're not going to drink it anymore." When he'd perform live, he'd stop mentioning Cristal. He took it out of the 4040 club, the sports club that he owns, and it felt like he made a decision on behalf of the rap community that they were going to distance themselves from Cristal.
Did they?
Yeah, in a big way. It was on Blueprint 3, onto the next one, where the Jay-Z line, "Used to drink Cristal, them fuckers racist."
Cristal's comments didn't just anger Jay-Z. They put the entire hip-hop community offside.
I said it must be, cause the nigga got dough.
That's ASAP Rocky on his track Goldie.
Cristal go by the cases. Wait, hold up, that was racist.
Catch that? Cristal go by the cases. Wait, hold up, that was racist.
So what do you think? I mean, what do you take from the comments that this guy had made and Jay-Z's response to it?
I think it's totally fair. You know, if Dare Iced Coffee had said to me, "We don't particularly like the Australian hip-hop community, but we can't stop them from buying it," I'd be like, "Well, you just did, and I'm not going to champion your product anymore the way that I do."
But for Jay-Z, a boycott alone wasn't enough. He had to get revenge.
This is state of emergency.
Just months after the comments by Cristal's CEO, Jay-Z released a song called "Show Me What You Got." In the film clip, a waiter approaches him with a bottle of Cristal and Jay-Z waves it away in disgust. The waiter returns with a silver case and opens it to reveal a gold bottle of Amont de Brognac champagne, better known as Ace of Spades.
H-O-V-A, gold bottles and an Ace of Spades. Why the fool with... So instead of Cristal, Jay-Z has decided to move on to Ace of Spades, which is a relatively unknown champagne that has kind of come out of nowhere.
Why was Jay-Z repping Ace of Spades? Was it just because he liked it?
Well, the impression at the start was because he liked it, but then it turned out they were throwing a bunch of money at him.
Ace of Spades sold out of its first production run, and according to representatives, every run after that.
It was definitely good for the Ace of Spades brand. You know, you started seeing it more, obviously in Jay-Z film clips, but across the board, it was just, you know, the new drink.
In 2014, Jay-Z bought Ace of Spades. Now, before you rush out to buy a bottle of Spades, keep in mind it'll set you back almost $500. And that's another important factor in which wines we choose, the price. A cheap wine might do the job for a quiet night in, but what about for dinner with the in-laws or a gift for a co-worker? Last year, the New South Wales Premier Barry O'Farrell lost his job over a $3,000 bottle of Penfolds Grange. It may not have been worth the premiership, but I wonder if it was worth the money. Not far from Barry's former workplace, the New South Wales Parliament, I sat down with sommelier Stuart Knox at his bar Fix St James. Stuart had just spent a week judging wines at the 2015 Sydney Royal Wine Show.
And in your experience with judging wines and working here, do you find that quality correlates very often with price?
Oh, look, as a rule, look, with wine by its very nature is that to produce a good quality wine, you've just got to spend a certain amount. It's rare that something that's retail for $10 or less, you can't get it into the bottle at that price to get a trophy. It's not commercially possible because of the required inputs in the vineyard and the reduced yields and all the work that goes into it. It means that it's got to hit a certain price point. But from $15, $20 up, then yes, you can.
So as long as you're, if you're in the wine shop and you're looking at the over $15, $20 mark, you're going to be getting enough quality there that you're going to get a good wine.
I'm quite happy to go into a bottle shop and spend $15 on a bottle of wine because most of the time it'll do what I expect it to do. Don't expect it $15 to $20 to really knock my socks off, but I reckon it should be a good wine. Once you get up to $25, $30, that's when you're getting into the surprise and excitement zone.
Stuart says there will always be outliers, an awful $50 bottle or a surprisingly good $3 cask. But on the whole, higher price means better quality, which makes sense. You spend more, you get more, right?
For a while, I'd kind of been growing more and more suspicious that at the very top end of the wine market, there was a lot of bullshit.
This is Robin Goldstein. He's a wine writer and journalist.
We all sort of go around spending more on wine when we a special occasion or you want to bring a special bottle to a friend and you sort of feel like, oh, I should spend more and get a nicer bottle.
But Robin wanted to know if treating yourself to the $50 bottle over the $5 one is even worth it. The critics think so. They consistently give the more expensive wines higher ratings. Robin told me that of the thousands of wines reviewed in Wine Spectator, the most famous wine magazine in the world, almost none of the wines below $15 to $20 had a score of more than 90 points.
I think a lot of people are kind of snobby and pretentious about cheap wines, you know, sort of writing them off as plunk or, stuff for amateurs.
So we know the critics don't like cheap wines. But what about when they don't know that the wine is cheap? In 2008, Robin held an experiment.
So the idea was to try to see what, if any, was the connection between price and people's preferences.
500 tasters, both amateurs and experts, and 6,000 different glasses of wine, ranging in price from $150 a bottle all the way down to $1.50. When they looked at the results, Robin was blown away.
Not only did the more expensive wines not taste better, but they actually tasted worse to most people.
When you took away the labels and price tags, old world versus new world, trends, fads, everything, the experts couldn't tell the difference between budget and expensive wines. And it gets better because the amateurs actually preferred the cheap stuff.
The best-selling wines, which are the cheaper wines, are actually made to the taste of most consumers. So the wine industry actually, at the lower end, has pretty much nailed it in terms of making the type of wine people like. And actually, the most expensive wine is made in a style that people like less. And to me, that suggests that if you're a wine producer and you want to make really expensive wine, you can't just make wine that tastes exactly the same as the cheap wine. It has to be distinguishable by consumers. It has to be different in some way. So since the cheap wine's already made basically perfectly according to consumer taste, the only way to differentiate the expensive wine is to make it worse.
Do you think that's what people are doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so they're doing things like when you look at the types of wines that get the highest scores in Wine Spectator and other magazines and rated by wine critics to be the very best wines, they tend to be very high in alcohol, very big, powerful wines with kind of a lot of tannin. And so these really kind of overpowering wines that get the very highest scores are actually not to my taste and I think not to the tastes of most consumers either.
So would you say that we should just ignore what the wine critics have to say? I mean, do they have any kind of value?
No, I think they have no value. I think we should just ignore them.
Every now and then, experiments like Robin's pop up in wine circles, and inevitably the sensational articles follow. Wine tasting is junk science. Wine tasting is bullshit. Dr. Alex Russell, the wine writer and psychologist who I spoke to about the Judgment of Paris, says people just like a good headline.
One famous study published in 2001 from France, which is called The Colour of Odours, where they got all these white wines and coloured them red artificially, so they looked like red wines, and got a whole bunch of people to describe the wines, and all these experts went into them and saw red wine. So they were describing these white wines with those words like plummy and blackcurrant and all that sort of thing, and they were tricked. And everyone, you know, always loves this story because it's like, oh, experts are fallible and, you know, maybe all this wine tasting's bullshit. And fair enough. I mean, I understand what they're saying, but no expert's infallible. You get a chess expert and they're going to lose a game from time to time. You know, we've got all these amazing expert sports people who make all these mistakes all the time. And we don't say that they're bad sports people or anything because of it. And we just say that they had a bad day. And the same can happen with winemakers and wine writers and wine judges as well, especially when you're actively trying to trick them like they were in those studies.
Here's Robin Goldstein again. Do you feel the same way about wine awards?
Yeah. So the wine competitions is also a big racket. There's a guy named Bob Hodgson. I'm not sure if you've come across his stuff.
This wasn't the first time Robert's name had come up. He's a bit of a celebrity in wine circles. And time after time, people said to me, if you're looking into competitions, you have to call Bob.
Philbrook Winery.
And I get the impression journalists call him a lot.
First ask, have you read the articles?
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Why? Why do you ask?
Well, a lot of people read things about the articles but haven't read the articles themselves. So.
Robert used to be an oceanographer.
Retired professor, winemaker, extraordinaire.
He now runs a small winery in Northern California. He's famous for holding an experiment at the oldest and most prestigious wine competition in North America, the California State Fair.
Let's see, I'm trying to think where to begin.
Wine competitions can be make or break for a winery. A gold medal can mean the difference between selling out and bust. But how does a judge decide that one wine is better than another? What special skills do they have that mean they can taste wine after wine after wine and definitively rank them from perfection to swill? This is what Robert wanted to find out.
The whole idea was to improve the competition. And the way we thought we would do that was by evaluate the judges and see which judges were better than others. And then perhaps we could weed out the worst judges and retain the best judges. And that would be a great thing.
At a competition, each panel of four judges receives what's called a flight of 30 wines. Of course, normally all the wines would be different, but the 2005 State Fair was no normal competition.
So sprinkled among these wines were 12 of these anonymous wines that we were using to test.
The same wine appeared three times in the flight.
And so we looked at the results and it was really quite shocking.
Most of the judges couldn't tell.
Looked like about 10% of the judges were not very good, 10% of the judges were quite good, and then 80% of the judges were sort of in the middle.
So 90% of the judges were either okay or completely terrible. Some of them were awarding the same wine a gold, then a bronze, then nothing at all. But
10% of the judges were quite good,
which Robert thought was better than none. But just to be sure, to account for good guessing, Robert went back the next year and held the same experiment, and it was not good news.
If you try to do a correlation or did a scattergram of judge quality one year versus the next, the correlation was virtually zero.
Virtually zero.
Just a meaningless bunch of dots on the paper.
The judges who had done poorly the first year did well the next, and the 10% who were supposedly good were now doing terribly. So according to Robert's data, winning a wine award all comes down to luck.
That was not good news. If you analyze that from a statistical point of view, it reinforces the idea that the medals that are given awards are very closely mimicked by a chance experiment.
I mean, did this impact the way that you see wine awards? Does it kind of make you think that there's less value in them now that you've done this experiment?
Oh, absolutely.
So, you own a winery. Would you continue to enter your wines into these kinds of competitions?
Oh, I do. You might think that's weird, but I realize that it's like don't know, do you ever go to a casino and gamble?
I've put money in a slot machine before.
Yeah, so my wife does it too. We know we're usually going to lose some money, but I'd save up all my quarters. Yeah. And she has a lot of fun at the slot machines. And yeah, I think we've got a chance to win. We've got a chance to lose.
I don't know. It seems like it's the kind of thing that's maybe good for the winemaker, but not so good for the consumer.
Well, that's been my mantra. Consumers need to look beyond the medals and try to figure out something else. Number one, I really encourage all consumers to get together in little wine tasting groups and taste wines and try to describe them and see what you like.
This sounded like a pretty good suggestion to me. I invited a few friends around for a wine tasting.
Hi, I'm Sophie.
My name is Hugh.
Andrew.
I'm Hugo.
I'm Raph.
I picked up 4 bottles of red, a $5 clean skin, an $11 Australian with a line of awards down the side, a $40 French, and a wine that had been lauded by the critics, a $100 bottle from the Barossa Valley called Amon Ra Shiraz. After dinner, I took my friends aside one by one. I got them to taste the 4 wines and tell me what they thought. And I've got to say, the results were mixed.
Number one, let's give it a go.
Some in drink number one.
Let's give it a swirl.
Number one was the $40 French.
Winter wine.
This is probably on the cheaper end of the scale.
Caramel.
And a peppery kind of flavour in it.
Bam, I'm alcohol.
It's bloody delicious.
Number two.
This was the very expensive Amon Ra.
It's more like vinegary or something.
Not methylated spirits, but like cleaning agent.
You can feel it more in your mouth, that one.
It's a bit softer.
A little more acrid. That's definitely smoother. Kind of like a nail polish thing from it.
Full-bodied.
Structured, I suppose.
Cinnamony.
Complex.
Like Christmas.
I think that's slightly more expensive. That's not really my sort of thing. I probably wouldn't drink too much of that one. It'd be so funny if this was like a $600 wine. Okay, number three. Ooh, number three is nice.
The $11 Australian.
Oh, I like number three.
I think that tastes cheaper.
It's a little dry.
A bit zingy.
It's much fruitier.
It's got that kind of alkaline-y taste.
It doesn't have too much taste to it, I don't think. I think this is meant to be a little bit special.
I don't know if I like it.
I quite like this one.
And lastly, the cheap clean skin.
Oh, wow. Tastes like citrus.
Bit smoother, this last one.
Too sweet for me.
Tastes kind of sour. It smells less fruity.
More like a sherry.
Tastes like a wooden ship on the high seas.
It's definitely smooth.
That would be my fourth favourite number four.
I couldn't drink a lot of that.
But it's also quite nice. I could probably drink that one.
There was no consensus. My friends didn't love the clean skin, but they seemed to enjoy the cheap Australian. They mostly liked the $100 bottle, but they didn't like the French. I was about to pack it in when at the last minute I decided to switch things up.
My name's Josephine.
I'm Joanna.
Hi, I'm Kat.
I gave these last three just 2 wines, and instead of asking them which one they liked the most, I asked them which one they thought was the most expensive.
I like more of the number one. So I would say maybe number one is more expensive.
But I'm going to say that 2 is more expensive.
Then I brought everyone back to the lounge room.
And the result is that they were the same wine.
No.
Shut up. What I would say is they tasted like they were the same type of wine, but that one was really vinegary. Like it was
Sure.
Yeah.
For me, the second was super sweet compared to the first.
I actually slightly chilled one of the wines. That was the only difference.
Oh. I thought the first one had...
Well, you can't begrudge me one little experiment. My last stop in the course of this story was a little vineyard in Berry called Silo's Estate, because at this point, let's face it, I needed a drink. It has a beautiful restaurant in a converted haystack looking over the vines. The owner, a guy named Raj, has been making wine here since 2007, and he's just starting to get his alpaca wool business off the ground. I ordered a glass of red, just whatever he had. Sitting in Raj's winery, I felt a bit disappointed. I was no closer to being a wine expert, and if anything, I felt even more confused. Robert had told me to ignore the awards. Robin had told me to stay away from the critics. Jay-Z had taught me that marketing is king, and history had shown me that wine trends can change in a second. Even my friends couldn't decide on what they liked. So I asked Raj, what makes a good wine? And why do we drink wine at all? And this is the story he told me.
You know, one of my favourite wines that I've ever purchased was a wine that I purchased from the Hunter Valley. It cost $14.95. I bought a case of it, and I remember the people I was with, and, you know, the day that it was, and, you know, it feels slightly foolish, but the, you know, flush of youth and, you know, no worries in the world and all that kind of stuff. And somehow the wine symbolised that time of my life and that experience that I had with those people.
So in some ways you're buying a story when you buy a bottle of wine.
I think so. So it's not just a story about brand and technological innovation and all those kind of things. I think wine is kind of slightly unique in that it's a social lubricant, and that it's about friends and family and occasions, and they don't necessarily always be happy occasions. There's occasions to commiserate and share with others. I that's one of the things I love about wine. It's so much more than what's in the bottle.
You've been listening to All The Best, and this week's episode was produced by Yasmin Parry. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. My co-host is Michael Bryden, and I'm Pip Rasmussen, who only knows to drink red wine with red meat and white wine with white meat. We make this show at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. If you want to hear more stories and subscribe to our podcast, head to allthebestradio.com. We're also played across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and the show is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.